Welcome to Biodiversity Speaks. I'm Dr. Helena Jolly, a scientist who studies human-nature relations and coexistence in indigenous landscapes. And today we have yet another amazing episode of Biodiversity Speaks. Today we have a geographer in the studio who works on biodiversity conservation. Her research focuses on tropical forest landscapes and explores the causes and consequences of disturbances and extreme events in these landscapes. She's a faculty at University of British Columbia and is here to speak about her work on tropical ecosystems. Please welcome Dr. Naomi Schwartz, Assistant Professor at the Department of Geography, UBC. Hello, Naomi. Welcome to Biodiversity Speaks. I'm very excited to have you here. Thank you for taking time to join.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you are a geographer working on tropical forest systems. The word tropics always brings this image of large trees, warm weather, forest that has sounds and rhythms. If you were to describe tropical forest, how would that be, say, to someone who hasn't been there ever before?
So, Helena, your description, it sort of evokes this pristine forest, a rainforest too, right? Big trees with buttresses, monkeys swinging from vines. And I think that's sort of this classic image of tropical forest. But that picture to me it's not necessarily inaccurate. There are tropical forests out there that look like that, but it's sort of incomplete. It's really only a certain subset of forests, but again, the ones that are most often represented in literature and movies, right? You think of Tarzan and Fern Gully and movies like that and images like that. But the reality of a lot of tropical forests is that they're not old growth, right? They don't necessarily have just, mass trees that you could never wrap, you need five people to wrap your arms around them. And they don't necessarily exist in these sort of big, unbroken expanses of forest as far as the eye can see. Rather, a lot of tropical forests, and the ones that I work in, are second growth, right? They're recovering from some form of either anthropogenic disturbance or some natural disturbance. They have smaller trees, less, not these big canopy emergence necessarily. A lot of tropical forests are also very fragmented, right? So there are still unfragmented tropical forests in, parts of the Amazon and the Congo, elsewhere in the world. But a lot of tropical forests now exist in smaller fragments in landscapes that, surrounded by human activities, right? In what you might call a working landscape. And then sort of the other aspect of what you talked about, this like humid, moist environment, this rainforest, is also kind of a limited picture of tropical forests. So many tropical forests are rainforests, but there is also other biomes, other tree-dominated biomes in the tropics that also cover a lot of areas. So seasonally dry tropical forests, for example, I've done a bit of work in seasonally dry tropical forests where you've got climate dominated by a strong wet season and then a very strong dry season, where during the dry season, the forest might actually look the way that an eastern deciduous forest in Canada looks, where all the trees shed their leaves. And so there's a lot of variation also in terms of climate and the way that climate shapes forests. And then, of course, within dry forests and sort of moving also into savannas, which aren't forests, but are also sort of tree-dominated biomes that are in the tropics, there's a lot of variation in structure, not just in terms of the size of the trees, but the density of trees, the stature, the shrubbiness, et cetera. So tropical forests really cover a much broader spectrum of climate and also of a sort of physical structure, degree of disturbance, degree of human influence than sort of, the image that is most commonly evoked in the popular media would have you believe.
That's really interesting now, because for me, tropics was always like this very Rudyard Kipling kind of an image of, the vast landscapes of, untouched humans and things. And on the contrary, what you were talking, one particular term that really got me excited was working landscapes. Because when we talk about, or when people read about tropics, it's often the terms are like without humans, right? And working somehow relates in some way to humans. So if for the audience, like, what do working landscapes mean?
So some of the places that I worked, there are places where there's been a lot of deforestation and there's pasture and forest fragments and, pastures surrounded by forest and forests surrounded by pasture, or oil palm or cacao plantations. So there's a lot of agriculture and other sort of human activity going on. But I kind of want to add and go back to, even the tropical forests that are quote unquote pristine, mm-hmm. many of them, or most or all of them, have fingerprints of human activities and human legacies in them. So even the forests that we think of that as pristine aren't.
That's really helpful. My next question is regarding like your own journey. So every scientist or researcher has a journey that led them to where they are today. So I'm pretty sure, Naomi, you have your own, you know, story to tell about like how you are here right now, a geographer working on biodiversity. So please tell us more about like what led you to this space and place.
Yeah. Reflecting back on my journey, I'm not one of those ecologists who has a story of, you know, ever since I was a young child, I was collecting bugs and I was always, you know, fascinated by insects. That was not me. I sort of fumbled my way through the first few years of university trying to figure out what my interests really were. I sort of floated between, I started university wanting to study physics. I had loved my physics class in high school and I always enjoyed science. I thought I'd be a physics major and then, you know, sort of went from there and swung in the far other direction after a few terms of some very intense physics courses into a policy major and then really missed the science and sort of fumbled my way through the list of majors and found this environmental science and policy major. I loved that because it let me take natural science courses, social science courses, and it really explicitly focused on the interconnections between humans in the natural world, which I felt like was sort of missing from when I had been a physics major for a minute there and a policy major. And so I really loved that. And then my last year of university, I took an ecology course and I just loved that course. We had a field trip. We went to the Kawita long-term ecological research site and I loved the fieldwork. I loved the toolkit that it gave you to observe and understand the natural world. It really just, I think, thinking through an ecological lens, just like really sort of turned on my fascination with the natural world in a way that just I hadn't really experienced before. And so I loved ecology, but I remained really interested in human-environment interactions and the ways that tools from ecology could help us understand the ways humans shape the environment. So I did my PhD on fire ecology and disturbance ecology in the Western Amazon in a region that is very fragmented. It's near the city of Pucallpa. It's the only Amazonian city in Peru that's connected to Lima by road. And so because it has that connection to the capital, it's been a hotspot for deforestation, for oil palm cultivation, et cetera. So I mentioned my training's in ecology, but I'm a geographer now, or I'm in a geography department. And I sort of became a geographer because the questions that really interested me the most were spatial and were sort of asked at sort of broader like landscape scales. So questions about why are the impacts of fire different here than here? Or why are the forests here more vulnerable to drought than the forests here? Mm. That spatial focus of my research led me to sort of embrace tools from geospatial science. So I used lots of GIS and remote sensing in my research and led to me ultimately being hired in a geography department where we have many faculty who were not trained as geographers, but who adopted as their discipline.
You have such a diverse set of, you know, journey milestones and things. And from all the titles that you were mentioning about the places, right? Amazon, you worked in Amazon, like in Asia and like, you know, mentioning about different places. You're truly like very global in your research, which is quite rare in terms of like a conservation sciences-based work. So one of the key aspects, I believe, Naomi, is your research focuses on understanding and looking at something called impermanence of reforestation trend. You mentioned reforestation here and there in your conversation before, which for me is super interesting. I was reading some of your papers and I kind of observed that, you know, reforestation is often seen from a very positive spectrum, right? Especially on its benefits of carbon sequestration and climate change mitigation objectives. Now, impermanence kind of brings a negative tone to it. Can you explain this a little bit further? So for the audience, reforestation, just to rephrase my question into a little less scientific ones, we often see reforestation as a big deal, beneficial thing. It's going to add value for climate change mitigation. And Naomi here is going to tell us like that's not always true. And there are some other nuances and details that we need to listen carefully.
Yeah. So that's a big question, something I've thought a lot about. So maybe I'll start with sort of just clarifying what we mean by reforestation. So reforestation refers to the reestablishment of tree cover where it had previously been removed, right? So either through clearing, deforestation, or maybe through natural disturbance or through logging, et cetera. Reforestation is the reestablishment of that forest cover, which may happen from active restoration like tree planting or could happen through natural regeneration. And so reforestation can be a great thing. Yeah, it is a great thing. Yeah, forests are lovely. It's wonderful when forests reestablish. And like you mentioned, second growth forests, so that's the term that I tend to use for forests that are the product of reforestation, right? So second growth forests have a whole slew of benefits for climate change mitigation, right? So regrowing trees suck carbon out of the atmosphere and store it in their biomass. They also can have major benefits for biodiversity, right? We mentioned that a lot of tropical forests and a lot of forests in general are highly fragmented. Reforestation can establish new habitat for important species, can reconnect habitats that had been previously disconnected. They can have positive impacts for local people's livelihoods as a source of timber or non-timber forest products or recreation or a place to graze cattle. Second growth forests are wonderful. And I'll mention, you know, we started the conversation talking about pristine forests and the image of tropical forests as pristine. And I would mention that for a long time, the field of tropical ecology and ecology more generally, like, didn't have much interest in second growth forests. They were sort of seen as not very biodiverse, not very important, weren't making huge contributions to biodiversity or to conservation. And I would mention that that has changed a lot in the last few decades. And now we have this big emphasis on second growth forests that has having this huge potential to help us with some of these really big environmental challenges that we face. These benefits take a while to accrue, right? Forests grow, I mean, tropical forests in wet places, they can grow really quickly, right? But carbon is instantly removed from the atmosphere and put in trees. It takes many years for this to happen, right? And same thing with biodiversity, right? Species accumulate over time. Very young forests tend to have much lower biodiversity and species richness and other measures of biodiversity. They increase over time as forests regrow. So these take time, and they also need to be maintained, right? And so that's where this question of permanence comes in, right? So permanence is really the degree to which these benefits are able to accrue and be maintained over time, right? And we need permanence to get the benefits that we're talking about. If tropical forests are going to contribute to climate change mitigation, they need to be permanent. Tropical second growth forests. Some of my work has worked to sort of quantify permanence using remote sensing. So remote sensing is using satellite imagery to monitor changes to the Earth's surface, right? So I've used these sort of time series of remote sensing imagery. So repeat images and maps generated from those images over time, showing changes in forest cover over time to sort of ask, okay, so where do second growth forests regrow? And then how permanent are they? How much can we really count on second growth forests to help us achieve these benefits? Because if you look at any particular snapshot in time, if you look at one moment in time, and you look at a map of where there are second growth forests, there might be a lot. So this work started, this sort of thread of my research started with my work in the Peruvian Amazon and the region that I worked in. There was a lot of second growth forests in any given time. But when you start to look at the remote sensing imagery over many years, you see that many of these second growth forests sort of flicker in and out of existence, right? So one fragment pops up here, there's some regeneration here, and then that disappears either because of clearing or in some cases, natural disturbance, and then some second growth forest is regenerating over there. But this lack of permanence of these second growth forest fragments really undermines their ability to contribute to conservation and climate change mitigation. And so some of my work has focused on trying to understand those dynamics. Where are forests permanent? Where aren't they?
So with this particular thing, I was even wondering, like you mentioned about tropical forests, secondary growth forests, they are good because they help in carbon sequestration. And you also mentioned that there is a requirement of these forests to be maintained in a certain way so that, you know, it takes time for these kind of activities to take place and we see the benefits over a long time. And there are external factors that are disturbing in some way, creating this impermanence, which again is kind of leading to the problem. So one of the things that I was wondering is in terms of like the tropical forest, if there is any disturbance, the loss of carbon associated with that particular disturbance, is it higher for tropics in compared to like, say, temperate forests? Have you seen something like that? I mean, I was thinking in terms of disturbances causing these impermanence.
Yeah, good question. I think it really depends. So a young forest being re-cleared, the carbon being released back into the atmosphere from that disturbance is not that much because there wasn't that much biomass in the forest to begin with. But if you think about the loss as sort of the lost potential carbon that could have been stored in that forest, it gets a lot bigger. And so some of my work has been sort of projecting the amount of carbon that would have been stored in tropical forests had permanence been higher, and what is the lost potential contribution to climate change mitigation when they're recleared, when they're beyond.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but I guess in terms of like the tropics versus elsewhere, it's so variable across biomes and within biomes. And then, of course, like the type of disturbance matters and the severity. So
yeah,
it is a hard question to answer.
Okay. So you were mentioning about your work, which started on in Amazon, and then you slowly moved into tropics in Southeast Asia, right? So at present, like, where is your work geographically situated? And like also in those areas of your work, what are some of the key drivers of this impermanence?
Yeah. So I have been doing some more recent work in Southeast Asia, which is maybe sort of related to the question about permanence. But most of the work in permanence has been located in Latin America.
Okay.
So I've done this work at a few different scales, which has been sort of interesting, like the different insights you get from looking at different scales. So I've done some analyses at sort of more regional scales. So this area where I worked in during my graduate work around in the Peruvian Amazon is sort of a smaller area about, I don't know, 100 kilometers squared. And some of this work also in the Atlantic forest in Brazil. But then I've also looked at these dynamics at continental scales using land cover data from across all of Latin America. So the most, like the proximate drivers, the most immediate drivers are just forests get re-cleared for various reasons, right? Or there's natural disturbance to some extent, right? There might be windstorms or fires or whatnot. And some reforestation also I would mention is kind of ephemeral by nature, like shifting cultivation, for example, right? Or sometimes people will plant fast growing timber species with the intention of cutting them down after 6 years or something like that. So some of this reforestation is ephemeral by nature. But then thinking about sort of the more indirect drivers of like, why are people reclearing forest? So there are, I guess, a few different reasons. So one has to do with the socioeconomic context, right? So the decision to clear forest is often conceived of as sort of an economic decision, right? I want to plant some oil palm here, right? There's an oil palm processing plant was built nearby. And so I'm going to re-clear some forest that had been regrowing on my land and plant oil palm, right? So there's economic drivers like, you know, proximity to markets, opportunities in cities versus in rural areas. And so, you know, you see in places where there's lots of rural to urban migration, you'll see reforestation. And then if some of that migration is reversed for various economic reasons, you then might see those new forests being re-cleared, right? And then there's, of course, political context and policy context. So in many places where there are laws that prohibit the cutting of old growth forests, cutting second growth forests is not prohibited, right? And so I should say preventing deforestation and clearing of old growth forests is much more important from a climate and biodiversity perspective than preventing the clearing of second growth forests. Like in a sense, sure, if people are going to clear forests, it's better that they re-clear these second growth forests. But at the same time, if we are expecting second growth forests to do a lot of work for us in terms of conservation, climate change mitigation, then they do need to be protected. And in a lot of places, there aren't legal protections. So for example, right, I worked in Peru. At that time, there were no legal protections. It was perfectly legal to clear second growth forest. And so that leads to those forests being re-cleared at a very high rate. And then also political instability and political changes can influence where you see forests being re-cleared. So for example, a famous example is sort of the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil increased deforestation rate. Another example from my work is we saw a lot of these sort of reversals of reforestation were really common in Venezuela in years where there was a lot of political and economic instability. And another region that we saw a lot of reversals of reforestation were in parts of Colombia that became accessible after the peace accord in Colombia, which, you know, so these changes to political context, national security, et cetera, can change people's access to land and then their likelihood to re-clear second growth forests. So,
oh, wow. So there are a lot of actors and stakeholders and players and everything when it comes to the drivers of impermanence, I guess.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Just like the drivers of deforestation. Right? This is very complex.
So yeah, like you mentioned about your work in tropics, like why tropics and why not some other ecosystems?
Well, I can give you the sort of scientific answer about why they're important. And then I can maybe just also give you the personal answer.
I would love to hear both.
Yeah. So which are intertwined. So permanence is a concern with all natural climate solutions, right? Any climate solutions that involve enhancing climate sinks, you need permanence, right? Otherwise, what's the point, right? So thinking about, you know, changing land management practices to enhance soil carbon storage in agriculture in British Columbia, for example. Permanence is a concern there too, right? How do we make sure that those land management practices are maintained and that that carbon stays in the soil in the long term? So it's not just the tropics where permanence is important. But the reason I think that this is an important thing to think about, especially in the tropics, is a few reasons. So one is, you know, land cover change is much more dynamic in many tropical countries right now than in, for example, North America and Europe. So, you know, we've in North America, we've already undergone what we call this forest transition, which is the transition from net deforestation to net reforestation over time, right? So in early days of European settlement in North America, there was lots of forest cleared for agriculture. And then as the economy changed, et cetera, a lot of that forest regrew. So we've sort of gone through that process. And in a lot of the global south, there is still a net deforestation trend, or maybe a sort of like a slow transition into a forest transition, and also some examples of countries where forest transitions have taken place. But in general, land cover is more dynamic in the site of more forest loss and much forest loss and gains in tropical regions. You know, the tropics, like I mentioned before, tropical forests are a really popular natural climate solution. They gain carbon really quickly. There are other benefits to increasing tropical forest cover. And they're one of the largest potential terrestrial carbon sinks, but they're also the target of a lot of policies and programs to mitigate climate change through increasing forest cover rates. So programs like REDD+ and other sorts of carbon finance programs are really focused on the global south and on tropical forests. And so I think it's especially important in that context that we think about tropical forests. For my own personal, partially has to do with, again, this interest in human-environment interactions and encountering systems that seemed like great places to study the questions that I was interested in. And also, I mean, I'm not going to lie, like there's the biodiversity. I would say like early on in my days of working in tropical forests, I was totally a victim of those tropes that you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation about, you know, the tropics are exotic and they're pristine and they're biodiverse and they are those things in some ways. But also now I sort of realize how some of those tropes are somewhat problematic. But I would say that that was, younger, more naive me many years ago was sort of drawn in by that. And then my work just sort of built from, you know, built in South America and now more in Southeast Asia over time. So
this is very fascinating, Naomi. I understand, like, you know, if I were you, I would also love to work in tropics, given, you know, you're always like sold with this big idea of like how tropics is and everything, right? But one point that you mentioned, which I found it really curious, was the fact that, you know, the importance of reforestation and how it helps in climate change mitigation globally and, you know, the role that tropics play, it's huge, right? And a lot of policies are surrounding that. So have you come across any kind of a discourse or a conversation where there is this kind of anti-reforestation conversation with the underlying reasons being that it in some way pushes some of these countries, which are usually tropics are usually in the developing part of the world or so-called developing part of the world. And there is a tone of, you know, the demand, higher demand for reforestation in these areas in some way are pushing those countries towards not economic development. On the other hand, most of these temperate forests or the forests in North America and Europe, which has gone through the reforestation, did also have an opportunity to, like, you know, pump up their economic systems out there. So do you see those sort of a conversation as a scientist working in this field, like the political conversations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And yeah, there are many critiques of sort of reforestation and tree planting in the tropics as a climate solution. And one of them is sort of, you know, what you bring up, like who benefits, right? So, I mean, I think some attempts at carbon finance at programs like REDD are attempts to circumvent that criticism. But whether or not those programs work, I think is a very big open question, who benefits from them. And then, you know, questions around tree planting schemes, tree plantations, et cetera, often the beneficiaries of these big tree plantations or tree planting schemes are not local people, right? Those benefits are received by people who are quite distant from those places. And there's actually a lot of interesting research out of India that's kind of critiquing. And then another critique, which you didn't bring up, but which maybe is a good segue into some of the work in Southeast Asia that we were maybe going to talk about, is where trees are planted, what areas are targeted for tree planting, because many regions in the tropics have lower tree cover because they're savannas or they're sort of, you know, woodland forests, savanna forests. And these regions have sort of lower tree cover, but are often targeted for tree planting and for increasing tree cover, which is not beneficial for biodiversity, right? It's maybe beneficial from a carbon perspective. So where tree planting happens is a big controversy as well.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Your topic is so interesting, Naomi. I have like tons of other questions, but I know that we do have limited time.
Yeah.
So I might just tweak in some of those questions in between. But yeah, for the next part of this section on this podcast, I would like to know, like, you know, what are some of your new ideas and projects? Your work is already such an incredible research. So we would like to know, like, what's the new exciting thing?
Yeah. Yeah. So I keep foreshadowing or hinting on this work in Southeast Asia that I'm super excited to talk about. So the newer work that's going on in my research group at UBC is this project around forest savanna mosaic landscapes in Southeast Asia. And we're specifically working in Cambodia. So you may be wondering, oh, savannas in Southeast Asia, what? But yeah, the region we work in, so we work in these, like I said, mosaic landscapes where you've got this patchwork of what are usually referred to as deciduous dipterocarp forests, which I argue are really should be classified and managed as more like savannas. And so that you've got these deciduous dipterocarp forests where you've got widely spaced trees, a continuous grassy understory, very open, high light environment. Frequent fire helps maintain low tree cover. So you have these frequent low intensity fires that just burn the grass layer. They'll kill small seedlings. And so keep the tree canopy fairly open and sort of, you know, refresh the grass, which has a lot of benefits for wildlife. And then they exist in these landscapes where they're very patchily distributed amongst denser, what we'd call a seasonal evergreen forest, which looks a bit more like that sort of classic tropical forest, even though it is quite seasonal, but the trees have leaves all year round, dense canopy, very humid microclimate, et cetera. And so with my lab group, we're working to understand what influences the distribution and the boundaries between the forest and savanna. So, you know, testing hypotheses about whether it's related to differences in soil characteristics, differences in fire, differences in land use history, and then also to understand how these systems might change in the future with shifting fire regimes. Mm. And this is a region where I'll just mention, just to link it back to what we were talking about with tree planting and red projects, where there's some controversy around these deciduous dipterocarp stands that, you know, some people argue that they're degraded forests, right? That they should have fire should be prevented in them, because when you suppress fire, more trees come in, the vegetation gets denser, and there's more carbon stored. And that is beneficial from a climate perspective, not necessarily from a biodiversity perspective. Like I mentioned, there are many wildlife species that rely on having a mosaic of different land cover types. And then there are also a lot of unique understory species that are only found in the understory of this deciduous dipterocarp forest. And the tree species, also the dominant tree species, they don't regenerate in the shade, right? So they don't regenerate in forest. So sort of questions about how these systems should be managed and should be restored for carbon and biodiversity are sort of very tricky. And so my hope is that this research that we're working on can help sort of clarify what are the best actions and the best management actions for these systems.
This is super interesting, Naomi, because when you were mentioning about this tree grassland ecosystems in Cambodia, right? Even in India, we have something similar, especially in the peninsula of India. And recently, there was a study which kind of showed that, you know, those were misclassified. So in those landscapes were misclassified as wastelands or like grasslands, which were not managed during the colonial times. And there was a fire suppression in those areas.
Yeah.
But the same kind of description, like, you know, sparsely placed trees and the grasses in between,
yeah,
how a lot of species, biodiversity is dependent on the fire. So if you're looking for a next site, make a visit to the peninsula of India. And a lot of work is going on in the fire-based work. And I'm sure, like, they would also love to learn more about your work in Cambodia.
Yeah. And I know some of your work has been around sort of fire management and indigenous fire use practices and how disrupting those practices can change an ecosystem. And so this is, I think, a phenomenon that's happened in a lot of sort of grassy ecosystems around the world.
Yeah. And sometimes I wonder, like, how poorly these systems are studied, like in terms of grasslands or like even like in many other parts of places, like even Canada, right? Like whenever we don't see a tree ecosystem, we often classify it as a wasteland or like a non-productive land, which can cause much more damage, right? Or in the long run, like what your research is showing, there's a way of maybe doing both.
Yeah.
Right.
There was a really fun paper that came out a year or two ago on bio, on what they the authors, they coined a term, biome awareness disparity, basically demonstrating that despite the global importance of grassy ecosystems, they're just really, they're a lot less sexy for the scientific literature in conservation. They analyzed literature, they analyzed tweets, and, you know, demonstrated how much more forests, there are tons of forests, they're super important, but they get just a disproportionate amount of attention and funding, et cetera, in conservation relative to grassy systems, which are really important from a biodiversity perspective and are under threat, you know, from land clearing and land use change, but also from these tree planting programs and this sort of like carbon focused management. So,
yeah, those are great points, Naomi. So my other question is regarding like your insights of your work in Southeast Asia. Does it draw parallels to observations in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's great parallels with the places that you're working in India, where sort of misclassification of ecosystems and this forest-centric mindset or this tree-centric mindset, you know, is potentially not great for biodiversity. And you see this also in North America, right? With fire suppression, and, you know, we've seen where that leads us in terms of like increased fuel loads, more severe fires, et cetera. So this is, yeah, a phenomenon. It's probably a legacy of colonialism that's influenced our sort of grassier, sort of lower tree cover ecosystems around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it all, it, like if you see the inspirations of all the colonial paintings and things, you often see forests as a representation of like mostly trees and meadows as like pasture lands for like cattle. But it's really interesting, Naomi, the fact that you're a geographer, you're also a field researcher. And while field research is exciting, I know that I myself do a lot of field research, but it comes with a lot of challenges, right? Especially in the field of biodiversity conservation. Do you relate to any particular challenge as a field researcher?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think it's funny to think what I might have said a few years ago versus what I would say now. So I think maybe 5 years ago, I would have said, you know, maybe I would have talked about some of the physical hazards, the heat, the, you know, also some challenges around sort of working, making, you know, connecting with local communities who need to sort of approve of your research and give you permission and hopefully even give you some suggestions of what are the interesting things to be working on. So those things are all really challenging. But I think the contemporary me, the biggest challenge that I face is probably around, so as you know, I have a 2-year-old son. And I would say that becoming a parent has really changed my capacity to do field work. And it was just so easy to slip away and just be gone for a few months. And now sort of figuring out how to be a parent and how to meet my responsibilities to my family and also maintain my field research is a huge challenge. And I think it's something that has also made me think a lot about like questions around privilege and who gets to do field work and who is it easy for. And there's been lots of conversations around race and gender and safety in the field and ability to go and do field work. And I think another component of this is like, do you have, you know, thinking about people who have care responsibilities to children or to older family members, how, you know, it can be, you know, very gendered, or all there can also be sort of a socioeconomic aspect of sort of, you know, whether you can just slip away to the field without, you know, just leaving your responsibilities. And I know that's something that you dealt with during your dissertation with a young child while you were doing massive field stint.
Yeah, I can totally relate to you. Like, and I think it changes as a parent, like a different stage of your kid's life. And like you said, like before the kid, life is always about like your work and everything. But then your work still is important, but then you try to like manage it in different forms and ways. Yeah, field work is definitely challenging. But I do see that, you know, there's so much fun in it, right? Being in the field. And now that my kid is like getting older, like I feel like I'm way more flexible in terms of field work and things. So
it's good to know there's a light at the end of that tunnel.
So which is true. And it's really nice of you, Naomi, to speak about these things, because a lot of people kind of think field research is like, kind of a pleasure to like trip. Like, you know, you go into the field, you're like doing engages. But there's a lot of trade-off involved for a lot of field researchers when they go into the field. And the aspect of like, you know, the privileges that each of us come with in many ways, having the ability to do field work, very often we don't recognize those things, right? Like, you know, if you have to care for your kid or you have somebody at home to care for, you know, it makes it difficult and challenging. So, it's really nice that you put voice to all those things. Thank you. So one of my final questions is, Naomi, I also know that you're a iBios member, which is an interdisciplinary biodiversity solutions collaboratory member at UBC. And you are at a leadership role in some of UBC's biodiversity conservation discourses and research here. Share some of the exciting things that iBios is doing currently.
A lot. I guess one of the things that just pops to mind, maybe because I was just working on it last week, but is we have a new graduate fellowship. So we've just selected our first few graduate fellows who will be helping us sort of figure out what does it actually mean to be a graduate student involved with iBios. And so I'm really looking forward to working with that cohort of students. We have an annual retreat coming up in August, which was, you were there last year. It was such a great time. And you know, I think that there's been, yeah, lots of new research collaborations. I think, you know, iBios has also, for me, just helped me, like, I think push myself to think a little bit differently about the research that I do, the ways that I engage with the places that I work, and also with others at UBC. And so it's hard to say, like, you know, listen, like, here are the tangible things we've done on that. But I think that a lot of people also feel the same way. And so I think we're going to keep having those, like, really exciting conversations. And as we have those, there's going to be more and more exciting research collaborations.
That's really good. So I would say, like, for our audience, keep a lookout on all the cool things that iBios is going to do in the future. They have quite a few, the graduate fellowship.
Yeah, and all the graduate fellows who are joining us are just doing really incredible research as well. So definitely keep a lookout for it.
So thank you, Naomi, for this wonderful discussion. I would have continued talking, but I know that, you know, you have very less time and you gave the time so graciously. So, and I've learned so much today about tropics, reforestation, the permanence, impermanence, and, you know, the importance and its challenges and all those things. And I feel like, yeah, I'm sure the audience are also enjoying it, listening to your conversations. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you want to hear more about Biodiversity Speaks, you can follow us on our socials, iBios Program, on Twitter and Instagram handles. This episode is hosted by me, Helena Jolly, edited by Liam Reed, and assisted by Emma Jurek-Simard. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but until we meet again, think of tropics and why some reforestation efforts need to be revisited. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.